Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I call this the Empowerment Hour. Everyone's invited to participate. No one is excluded. We do not have a religious or political or ideological point of view to share, and therefore people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, can benefit. Today, the latest on health and healing, and not information you would normally find in the mainstream or alternative media, we go to the actual science, to the peer-reviewed literature to show you what's new. For example, you have not heard, I can promise you, you've not heard of PQQ. What is PQQ? Quite simply, one of the most important discoveries of the mitochondria in the bioenergetics is this enzyme, coenzyme, that can actually rejuvenate your energy. Not just repair it, actually create new mitochondria. We never thought this was possible. It is. Commentaries from Bill Falloon and Perry Marcone on that. A little later, my guest, Thomas Epell. He is a visionary philosopher akin to the transpersonal psychology tradition of consciousness studies. He's an expert in sustainable living. Why? Because so many people in this audience believe, as do I, that for about 70 million Americans, things are fine. They're going to be fine, and for all intents and purposes, outside of the weather and the variables of that, you're not going to notice that the world is a different place. The services you expect, the foods, the restaurants, the dining, the entertainment will all be there. But what about for the remaining 240 million Americans, or two-thirds of the population? Oh, that's a different story. And for those individuals, whether they're the professional class who've had to substantially change their lifestyles, or the working class, or the middle class, or the poor class, there's going to be a bumpy road ahead. So when people say, how can I help myself in the future if I do not see the state or county or federal government helping me? All right? How do we do that? We're going to explore sustaining ourselves, exploring the roadmap to reality, and how we can distance ourselves from those artificial and illusionary concepts of the future and deal with the reality of the future. So that will be a part of our program you will not want to miss. Commentaries, and I'm doing commentaries every day to awaken our consciousness for those who need that awakening. Today, Incipient Fascist State, America Has Gone Awry, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Then, commentary from Danny Schechter, Is Fascism Lurking? And finally, Michael Snyder from Op-Ed News, 19 Facts About the Deindustrialization of America That Will Blow Your Mind. Later today, over the Progressive Radio Network at 6 p.m., I will be the guest. I was just informed on the Mitchell Rabin Show, and I'm going to give a long commentary, probably taking up most of the hour, though the host doesn't know that yet. That's what you get when you invite me on. My commentary, dude, where's my job? So you won't want to miss that, and that will be at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time over the Progressive Radio Network. And finally, some upcoming shows. We pride ourselves on bringing people to the airwaves that generally do not go on either the right or left-wing media because they have issues. They don't want to align themselves with those ideologies. But on ours, since we do not have that kind of left-right, but rather truth, we get people such as Clifford Miller. He is a barrister for the Supreme Court of the Government of England. And this will be a continuation of our investigation. Now, all the journalists in the United States, led by Anderson Cooper on CNN, tarred and feathered Dr. Andrew Wakefield, stating that his claims that the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, was associated or caused autism was the red herring. Then the British Medical Journal and an investigative a journalist over there named Brian Deere all jumped on. Here's something that was left out. How about the truth? At no point anywhere in any of the writings did any of the scientists, and by the way, Andrew Wakefield was only one of the nine scientists, none of them made a claim that that autism and MMR vaccine was related. In fact, Andrew Wakefield and all those doctors are pro-vaccine, as were the parents. But no one investigated or interviewed the parents. We have. No one looked at Brian Deere's real background. We did, and we'll show you the connection with the pharmaceutical industry in Britain. No one looked at the association of people with the British Medical Journal. And did they break the law? Did they engage in a criminal act according to British law? We will show you the evidence that can be brought against the British Medical Journal and those affiliated with the slandering of an innocent man. This time, we're not going to wait till someone's been executed in the public opinion by being some criminal. We're jumping in and we're going to provide the defense that the mainstream media should have had the integrity and decency to do. So when you hear about Andrew Wakefield, virtually everything you're hearing are lies manufactured by the pharmaceutical industry because they don't want any light shown on the danger of the MMR vaccine. And we'll show you how they're able to use journalists, newspapers, including the Times of London, as well as the British Medical Journal and the entire British medical community, how they can manipulate it. Who are they? They have names, they have faces, they have positions, they have associations. Our investigation, and by the way, just so you're aware, and many of you are, I do more original investigative reporting than any other journalist in American history, over 300. We break the big stories. We don't do the little puffball pieces that the Washington Post and some of those people call themselves journalists do. Go back and look at our articles on the politics of cancer. Did they do them? No, not one. The politics of AIDS? Not one. We have. Now we'll show you the politics of vaccines. That will be tomorrow. And who do we have? We just have probably the brightest lawyer with the Supreme Court as a barrister in England who will be giving testimony over the air in an exclusive interview tomorrow at noon. At 3 p.m. tomorrow, as 2012 approaches, we will infrequently bring a guest on who has the breadth of understanding and expertise on the issues coming up in 2012 and put it in a historical perspective. Tomorrow will be Dr. Robert Stittler, an anthropologist and Mayan expert and Mayan linguist who has spent over 30 years with the Mayans in the highland of Guatemala and the Chapasas region of southern Mexico. And he will share with us what the real Mayan philosophy is. Then Wednesday, Robert Kavner, a 30-year veteran of the oil and gas industry with deep experience in operations, will be sharing inside information you have not heard before. For the first time, exclusively, the collusion between British Petroleum and our federal government and what led up to the British Petroleum spill. You thought you knew the truth? You're not going to find the truth from the Washington Post. You will hear it here. And then finally, on Thursday, Dr. Andrew Wakefield will be given an opportunity to be asked the questions, but ask the questions in not an accusatory manner, but ask the questions and giving him a chance to present his evidence that was not given, along with Barbara Fisher and Dr. Robert Sears, who were all attacked by Dr. Paul Offit, who was the leading pro-vaccine scientist in the United States. And we will give these people an opportunity to share their thoughts on vaccines. It seems that in all of America, in the history of America, everyone says vaccines were safe and effective, but no one chose to speak with the parents. And as if they didn't count, as if they were irrelevant. Well, in our world, parents are very relevant, and you'll have a chance to hear some of the advocates of parents' groups when it concerns the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So that shows you why we are the number one listened to radio program in the world for progressive-minded, independent-thinking people. Let us begin. I will get as much of this information in today as possible. From Bill Falloon, who I've been filming for this new major documentary I'm working on now, I have, one of the things I do anytime I sit with a person is I try to find out what is their level of energy compared to a year ago or 10 years ago before condition. And almost inevitably, when a person's depressed, has diabetes, heart disease, cancer, arthritis, you name the condition, the mitochondria, which are the little energy factories in the body, is diminished. And one of the things that actually represents a hallmark of aging is that as we get older, we're slower. We can't think as well. We don't have the speed we once had or the strength. Why? Mitochondria. They diminish. In fact, in the U.S. Library of Medicine at their website, you'll find 351 scientific studies published just this year on mitochondria and aging. Now, the consensus among researchers is that mitochondrial dysfunction plays a central role in the development of virtually all age-related diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, skin sagging, you name it. Go back nearly 40 years, however, and a very little was known about a mitochondria. And when we first began talking about it on this radio program, few physicians understood our rationale that if you eat more green foods and more fruits and you ate more of your diet raw and you ate living foods, meaning you didn't overcook, just cooked enough so that your grains and legumes could germinate and release their energy, all that was dealing with mitochondria. You have a glass of orange juice, apple juice, fresh made, cucumber juice, watermelon juice, you enhance your mitochondria. Now have a soda, coffee, you decrease the mitochondria. But it takes a long time for science to catch up with personal experience. Remember, reality always supersedes scientific verification. But in the United States, we have this very odd way of looking at things. We say science must first prove your point or your reality is not acceptable. So we've made science the final arbiter of all reality instead of our human experience, our perceptions, our senses, cause and effect. In which case, then you can manipulate this. So you can say, cigarette smoking doesn't cause any disease because we have no science to prove it. Synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women to overcome hot flashes does not cause any problems. It helps prevent heart disease. But there was no science to prove it. The science then ended up showing that, oh yeah, cigarette smoking does hurt you, and synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women causes an increase in, a big increase in breast cancer, ovarian cancer, dementia, colorectal cancer, heart attack, and stroke. They said saccharin was safe. It was not. Genetic engineered products are safe. They are not. That the glyphosate, the Roundup chemical, doesn't harm you. It does. In fact, what's remarkable to me is virtually all the experts brought forward on public health issues have been wrong on every single issue. Isn't it amazing that the people who are consistently wrong, never right, are always accepted to be first in line to give their opinion of what is right the next time any issue comes up? That's what's remarkable to me. If you have a pattern of being a consistent liar, a deceiver, why would I go to you for my next source of information? And yet we go to the energy cartels. We go to the information cartels. We go to the big agri cartels and select their best representatives to oversee all governmental input, therefore guaranteeing that only one side of an issue, the official side, always wrong, is the only one given. And then we sanctify this by having former politicians or current politicians align themselves with these special interest groups, knowing that's their future. That's who's going to pay their meal tickets in the future. So all this gets back to the fact that our diet is extremely overprocessed, therefore denying our body the benefit of a good mitochondria or energy production. Now, then we came along and I told this audience, I was the first radio show in the United States to explain coenzyme Q10 and carnitine and alpha-lipoic acid that support the mitochondria function. And it's critical that new mitochondria are generated if we're to protect against age-related diseases. Well, now we're at what is known as mitochondrial biogenesis. It's the process of creating new mitochondria within our cells. And our mitochondria, which are the little energy factories in our cells, can be rejuvenated in response to intense aerobic exercise and caloric restriction. Quite simply, the more you exercise, and the more you are concerned about not overeating and taking in nutrient-rich calories instead of just dense calories. Like bread is a dense calorie. Sugar is a dense calorie. But if you eat a calorie from an apple, that's an enriching calorie. University of California, Davis released a peer-reviewed publication this past year showing that a natural compound called PQQ, which is in the quinone family, promotes the formation of new mitochondria within cells. And for the first time, humans are empowered with a natural agent to reverse the deadly decline in functional mitochondria that underlies degenerative diseases and premature aging. Now, about 95% of cellular energy is produced from structures in the cells that we call mitochondria. And unlike other cell components, mitochondria are able to divide within healthy cells. Now, mitochondria are required for cellular energy production. An impaired mitochondrial metabolism is now recognized as associated with virtually every disease. And the initial interest in taking nutrients like L-carnitine, maybe 500 to 1,000 milligrams, coenzyme Q10, depends upon your level of health. If you had multiple sclerosis, if you had ALS, if you had Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, I would start you at 2,000 milligrams. If you're a regular person, younger, I would maybe suggest starting at 300, 100 milligrams three times a day, taken with 50 milligrams of NADH because it acts as co-catalyst, and they work together. And that suddenly helps boost the mitochondrial energy in your heart muscle and in your brain. That's right. We don't realize how much energy is required by the neurons, the brain cells, to carry out their specialized functions. Well, studies in this past year corroborate the role of abnormal mitochondria dynamics with neuronal cell death and the onset of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and Huntington's. Well, if you live to 80 years, there's a 30% chance you'll develop Alzheimer's dementia. And we've identified specific pathogenic mechanisms that reveal the role of the mitochondrial dysfunction in initiating the progression of this hideous disease. Well, now, damage to the mitochondria of endothelial cells is an underlying cause of atherosclerosis. In traditional risk factors for arterial disease, smoking, obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, they're all linked to mitochondrial injury. When a person suffers persistent coronary artery blockage, a severe weakening of cardiac muscle can occur that results in congestive heart failure. Well, a study published this past year looked at left ventricular heart muscle tissue in patients with end-stage heart disease and normal hearts, and compared to normal hearts, mitochondrial DNA was decreased by 40% in the failing hearts. And this was accompanied by a reduction by 80% in the mitochondrial DNA encoded proteins of failing hearts. So the doctor said, you know, your mitochondrial DNA, that's essential. Well, what helps that? Well, coenzyme Q10, L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid. And now we can add to that PQQ to promote new revolutionary mitochondrial biogenesis, the formation of healthy new mitochondria. And that's going to lead to improvements in cardiac conditions, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, all forms of heart problems. It's just going to be tremendous. And by the way, cancer is fundamentally connected to mitochondrial dysfunction. A decline in mitochondrial energy production with aging is associated with the generation of increased free radicals, which cause mitochondrial mutations. And these mutations interfere with the normal cell removal process known as apoptosis. A critical factor in protecting against cancer is the ability to eliminate damaged cells through this apoptosis. Researchers are focusing on the huge energy-dependent process required to eradicate this abnormal growth. And that's where new mitochondria can come in. So I wanted to share that with you today because we always like to give you stuff that's ahead of the curve, and that sure is ahead of the curve. I'm Gary Noll. By the way, tomorrow, taking control of your blood sugar levels with targeted nutrient compounds. I have a lot of new science showing you what can be done to help control your blood sugar if you are pre or diabetic. All right, and I'll go into those tomorrow. You're going to learn all about some cinnamon, polyphenols, and other things that can help you. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm on the road filming. I'm filming three separate documentaries, and there's two ways to look at an issue. You can read a book, you can read a magazine, you can go on a blog site and hear what all the bloggers have to say, or you can do something rather unusual today in America. Actually go out and go around the country and speak with people in different regions outside of New York City and Los Angeles and see there's an actual country that exists and outside of the Washington, D.C. Beltway and see who's out there. What are they saying? How do they feel? And that's where I'm at. And I'm working to finish three major films in the next 2 weeks. And for those of you down in Biloxi and over in Texarkana and a lot of places in Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, I'm filming there over the next 2 weeks. A couple commentaries, and then we're going to say hello to Steve inside our studios in New York City. I promised you two commentaries. One's an important one, and because it deals with this whole idea that President Obama, and his own unique and smooth rhetoric, will try to convince us that we really need the unshackle business. Because if we get rid of some of these pesky little, you know, nonsense regulations, then they'll be free to spend money, create new jobs, help us all boats rise. Okay, fair enough. Trouble is, doesn't work. When Clinton got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, with the same people who Obama brought in to guide him, that's what led to the derivative trading and credit default swaps and the massive casino capitalism. And everything they told us was a lie. I believe we should re-regulate bringing back in the Glass-Steagall Act. I believe we should make it against the law to trade in commodities essential to life. Because after all, what happens if you can have the power as a hedge fund or a big bank and you know you can get all the money you want from the Federal Reserve, all the money, and it's given in secret and no one knows you've got it and you didn't have to pay a penny interest and you can charge interest. You can put it into, oh, let's say, debit cards. You could charge 200% interest if anybody misses a payment. Oh, yes. Well, whose money is that? Well, that's the Federal Reserve's. And who's that? That's the American taxpayer. Well, did they know you were getting it? No, it's all secret. I'm going to show you how it is and just give you one example of this. This is from John Vital from The Guardian. Quote, food speculation. People die from hunger while banks make a killing on food. It's not just bad harvests and climate change. It's also speculators that are behind record prices, and it's the planet's poorest who pays. Now, I won't go into the article. It's a big article, but it shows about how prices are rising by 40%. Well, what if you're a poor person? What if you need that flour or rice or cooking oil, but now you can't afford it? Too bad. You starve. But it's not always about a drought or monsoon. It's about people who can manipulate the prices of a commodity. Do they need the money? No. These are very rich people. These are in the 1% richest people on earth, the George Soroses. And yet, these are the people who are considered the great gurus. Do we ever actually look at how they made their money? And what are the unintended consequences from them making the money? Never. Go to Davos and the Economic Elite Summit and see if they ever look around the room and say, hold on, didn't you make your money speculating and didn't you make your money in currency and didn't you make your money in causing the price of oil to go up? Didn't you make your money in, yeah, they did. Didn't you privatize water and yeah, we did. And didn't that mean people couldn't even have water unless they paid for it and they couldn't afford it? Yeah. No one questions it. That's how bad it is. So, let's hear a clip. Please stay with us. This will be interesting for you.
Did you hear about the Fed?
No. What about the Fed?
They announced another round of the quantitative easing.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to make large asset purchases via PAMO.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to expand their balance sheet and buy treasuries.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to print a ton of money.
So why do they call it the quantitative easing? Why don't they just call it the printing money?
Because the printing money is the last refuge of failed economic empires and banana republics, and the Fed doesn't want to admit this is their only idea.
So why do they want to print the money?
Because they say we have the deflation, and the deflation is very bad.
What is the deflation?
The deflation is when prices of the things we buy go down.
Isn't that good? Doesn't it mean the people can buy more of the stuff?
Yes, but the Fed said this is bad, especially during the recession.
So they think that during the recession, when the people have less money to buy the stuff, it is bad that the prices go down?
Yes, the Fed would rather have the inflation.
So why does the Fed think we have the deflation?
Because the CPI said so.
But aren't the food prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the gas prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the healthcare costs higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't tuition prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the taxes higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the subway fares higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the stock prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the bond prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
So what is deflating right now?
The only thing deflating that I can see is the Fed's credibility.
Did they have a lot of credibility to start with?
No.
Why not?
Because the Fed has been wrong about every major economic development in the past 20 years.
You mean they didn't see the internet stock bubble?
No. In fact, they helped fuel the internet stock bubble.
And they didn't see the housing bubble?
No, in fact, they helped cause the housing bubble.
And they didn't see the subprime crisis?
No, in fact, they told us subprime problems were contained right before the hit the fan and the Lehman went bankrupt.
So has the Fed ever been right about anything?
Let me see if I can think of anything. Nope, nothing.
Who runs the Fed?
The Fed is run by the Ben Bernanke.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of business experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no business experience.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of policy experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no policy experience.
Has the Ben Bernanke ever run in an election?
No, the Ben Bernanke has never run in an election.
So what qualifies him to run the Fed?
I don't know, maybe the fact that he has a nice beard.
But my plumber also has a nice beard, and I would not trust him to play God with the economy.
No, although when you call the plumber to fix something that is broken, they usually fix it, not break it more.
This is true, the plumber is clearly smarter than the Ben Bernanke.
Well, that is why he became a plumber, and not an economist.
How does the Fed execute the quantitative easing?
They print the money, and then they buy the treasury bonds.
Do they buy the treasury bonds from the Treasury Department?
No, they buy the treasury bonds from the Goldman Sachs.
You must be shitting me.
No.
So let me get this straight. If I want to buy the treasury bonds with my money, I can buy them directly from the treasury.
Yes.
And if you want to buy the treasury bonds with your money, you can buy them from the treasury.
Right.
But if the Ben Bernanke wants to buy the treasury bonds using the American people's money, he does not buy them from the treasury, he buys them from the Goldman Sachs?
Exactly.
And does the Goldman Sachs give him a good price?
Of course not, they are the Goldman Sachs, they make their living ripping off the American people.
But how is the Goldman Sachs able to do this?
The Fed announces what it is going to buy, and when it is going to buy, before it does the trade.
So the Goldman Sachs can front run the Fed, and give them the worst possible price on the treasury bonds?
Yes, exactly.
And the Fed is okay with this blatant theft from the American people?
Of course, otherwise, the Fed would just buy the treasury bonds directly from the Treasury Department.
Who inside the Fed is responsible for the buying of the treasury bonds?
The buying of the treasury bonds is conducted by the New York branch of the Federal Reserve.
And who is in charge of the New York branch?
The head of the New York branch is the William Dudley.
And what did the William Dudley do before running the New York Fed?
Before running the New York Fed, the William Dudley was a partner at the Goldman Sachs.
So the guy in charge of the American people's money when dealing with the Goldman Sachs used to be a partner at the Goldman Sachs?
Yes.
And nobody has a problem with this?
Apparently not.
Is this an episode of The Twilight Zone?
I don't think so.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
So what you are telling me is that the Fed thinks prices are going down, when in fact they are going up?
Yep.
And they think during the recession, with the high unemployment, it is better if the things people need to buy cost more money.
Correct. According to the Ben Bernanke, the inflation will create the jobs and improve the housing market.
Has this ever been tried before?
Yes, just last year the Fed tried the quantitative easing with $2 trillion.
Did that create the jobs?
No.
Did it help the housing market?
Not at all.
Did it help anybody at all?
Yes, it helped the Goldman Sachs.
How much of the money are they printing now?
$600 billion.
So even though the first $2 trillion did not create the jobs or improve the housing market, the Fed decided to do another $600 billion anyway?
Yes.
Who put the Ben Bernanke in charge?
The Ben Bernanke was first appointed by the President Bush, then he was reappointed by the President Obama.
But wasn't the President Obama supposed to bring the change?
Yes.
How is putting in charge the same fool, who has been wrong about everything, the change?
Well, under the President Bush, the Ben Bernanke only blew up the American economy. Under the President Obama, he is working on blowing up the entire global economy.
That does not sound like the change we can believe in.
Definitely not.
Who else supports the Ben Bernanke?
Most economists around the world think the quantitative easing is very dangerous.
Does anyone think it is a good idea?
Yes, the people at the Goldman Sachs.
Is this some kind of nightmare?
No, it is very real.
I want to bang my head against the wall.
You should not do that.
Why not?
Because the healthcare is too expensive.
But didn't the President Obama fix that?
No, but that is the subject of a whole other video. Goodbye.
Just give you an idea that we're not alone in taking a look at the fact that the Federal Reserve recently was giving $3.2 trillion in 21,000 secret transactions of money at zero interest to hedge funds, major corporations, foreign governments, without any of this being revealed to the American public. We only found out because Bernie Sanders filed a Freedom of Information Act and got this information. So that's that. So much for transparency, and that all we need is some more money thrown at major corporations and everything will be all right. It won't be. Steve Lopez, our social media director in New York City in our studio. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Before we go to our guest in a few moments, I'll save some of my other commentaries for tomorrow. What's on your mind, Steve?
Well, this past Monday we had a terrific guest on the show, Dr. Harriet Washington, an incredible scholar. Her book, Medical Apartheid, was the first and, in my understanding, most comprehensive history of medical experimentation on African Americans that exists. The interview was terrific, and over the course of the discussion on Monday, the issue of vaccination and its role in population control and eugenics was raised. And on today's show, we want to go a bit further on the subject and shine some attention on some resources that we found and illustrate and detail the true heinous nature of the role of vaccines in controlling the population. First, we found an article by F. William Endall, author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. And in the paper, Endall describes the role of Microsoft founder Bill Gates in promoting eugenics initiatives in vaccination, where, quote, in plain English, one of the most powerful men in the world clearly states that he expects vaccines to be used to reduce population growth. And that's fairly scary stuff. The next was published in the Feminist Women's Health Center. It was an article describing the testing of a vaccine against pregnancy. Now, this is particularly disingenuous because the term vaccination in this context is a bit of a misnomer. Vaccines against disease work by stimulating and increasing the body's ability to defend itself against a specific germ. And worldwide, vaccines have had positive health impacts by stopping the spread of many serious diseases in some cases. But the implication that a baby is a germ is divisive, to say the least. Finally, we have an article that you, Gary, had authored with Richard Gale titled Death by Vaccination, the Gates Foundation and the New Genetics, which further and perhaps more comprehensively than the first article presents the facts on Bill Gates' involvement and support in population control via vaccination. Now, all of these articles are available to be viewed on our website, GaryNoll.com, and I heartily recommend that you check them out. They're terrific, informative, enlightening reads, and serve as an excellent primer to the subject, which is not entirely understood by most folks. Would I be accurate in saying that, Gary?
Yes, that's correct. We do a very scholarly work in writing articles that take an important and controversial topic, and without any bias, we simply look at the facts, those that can be demonstrated and repeated. So when someone says, well, there's no effort to vaccinate people around the world to prevent their prevent them from being pregnant, oh, yes, there are. And in fact, we actually have Bill Gates' actual statements verbatim on this. And then you have to tie it into two other issues. Historically, if you mention that there are elite groups of individuals who meet on a regular basis, like semi-annually or annually, and they give their ideas to one another. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. accept that these are the most powerful people in all fields, and they come together as a group of elitists. The public is excluded. There's no reporting on it. It's all done in secret. And they do it in secret because they want these very rich people to be able to share their honest ideas about the problems they see. Again, I have no problem with anyone. It's completely legitimate for wealthy people to get together and decide, gee whiz, how do we see the world? The problem is that then these are frequently implemented in various regional or states or in federal governments or in the major media. They take a slant. And how do you get into these groups? You simply have to be very rich, which then means you're very powerful. How you made your money to get in the door is irrelevant. So you could be a hedge fund guy who made it in trading in commodities where other people starved to death because you wanted to make money and you were smart enough to manipulate the prices. So you're invited in the door if you're a billionaire, and there are a lot of hedge fund people who are invited. Well, what gives them the right to assume that anything they're going to share should end up as public policy? And all of them have something in common. They are all globalists. They believe in the neoliberal principle of globalization and privatization of common used resources. I do not. I'm opposed to globalization as it's manifested. I'm opposed to the privatization of water, electricity, transportation, our road system, because then you have to assume that there will be people who cannot afford to commodify those who can. And you don't look always at what happens to the 240 million Americans who can't afford something. And these are the people who believe if you can make a profit from it, it's okay to do it. And that breaks into two different ways. There's now a movement, and there's about 44% of the American public who call themselves independent. Within that are a number of former Democrats and Republicans. There's also many liberals who are progressive and many conservatives who are also progressives. You can be conservative and progressive, and many have withdrawn from the hard, rigidified, the beliefs of the demagogues within the Republican or the Tea Party, as there are on the left, those who believe that we should not be constantly making compromises because we're Democrats or someone says they're liberal. What do you actually do that is progressive? And that's what determines. Are you looking for solutions that help everyone? Those who are really progressive look without any thought of your body politic, your race, your income. How can we help you make it a better world? That's what a real progressive is. And whatever they came from, whatever they morph from, is just what they morph from. But we have had no organization. Well, these people who meet generally, like the Koch brothers, who have been so instrumental in determining the outcome of local and national elections because now they can put any money in. These are the people who believe that they have a right to determine our future. And I'm just as determined to say, no, you don't. You have a right to determine your own future. I have no question about that. You don't have a right to determine everyone else's. So now, finally, we are looking more honestly at what it really means in the United States to be a democracy. And when we look at what a democracy is, and we look up at our Bill of Rights, and we look at the constitutional issues for what they are at their best, we see that we have failed today to be a real vital democracy of and for and by the people. It is for the rich. We have more of a plutocracy, the rich having enormous influence over the political process and by extension by the laws and rules that we are all supposed to live by. As a result, they've been able to deindustrialize the United States, take the jobs out of the United States and put them in China and put them in India and put them in other countries. 42,400 factories have closed in the United States since 2001. Did you know that, Steve?
I did not know that, no.
42,000 factories in the last 10 years. Dell, one of America's largest manufacturers of computers, has announced plans to dramatically expand its operations in China. He's going to invest $100 billion over the next decade in China. How about the United States? What it's going to do in the United States? It's going to close down its Winston-Salem, North Carolina place and get rid of 900 jobs or substantially get rid of all those jobs. And in 2008, there was 1.2 billion cell phones sold worldwide. How many of them were made in the United States? Steve?
Was that a rhetorical question?
No, a statement.
Goodness, I don't know.
How about not one? All right? Out of 1.2 billion.
Wow.
Yes, and so we have to look at what it means. We've lost 5.5 million manufacturing jobs since 2000. So what has happened is we have deindustrialized the United States, all in this neoliberal concept. And these are the people, more often than not, who have the most power to make decisions about our lives. And that's why I'm doing more and more to show what we are today versus the illusion of what we believe we are. So thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Everyone, I did a commentary this afternoon from Chris Hedges. He takes strong umbrage with what many who consider themselves liberal, but I would suggest not the progressive liberals, and I think you should have made a distinction that, are not doing lots of meetings. But one of the things he criticized is something I'm actually going to be a keynote speaker of, and I would hold a different point of view. I believe that we should have meetings. And I believe that from these meetings, including the Left Forum, that we can generate consensus on how we can take on certain issues. And therefore, I believe that we must be far more open to maintaining ongoing dialogue, because you never know what positive things can come from ongoing dialogue. I believe that's part of, you know, he's just become a little too cynical on that level. My guest is Thomas Appel. He's a visionary philosopher. I mentioned his background earlier in transpersonal psychology. He is the author of Roadmap to Reality, Consciousness, Worldviews, and the Blossoming of the Human Spirit, which explores various levels of conditioned worldview. And he's with us today. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you, Gary. I really appreciate the invitation.
Perhaps a good place for us to begin is with exploring a certain definition, which is self-awareness. Now, we claim we are aware of ourselves, but then what does this really mean? And if there were a universal perception of ourselves, then we would assume that there would be uniformity. However, that is far from the case. So self-awareness, something inherent in a human being, and if not, what is the alternative that we're left with? So let's begin there.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a fascinating thing because there's always this debate about how conscious animal species are. You know, are these animals self-aware? And we're sort of constantly running tests on these animals, but we haven't given a similar test to humans to find out, you know, do we pass a test for self-awareness? And the more you start to look into that, the less it appears that that is the case. To give you an example from another culture, I guess, the fascinating story from World War II is that when the foreign troops were in some of these South Pacific islands setting up army bases, they were hauling in all kinds of goods by ship and by airplane, and then they shared some of those with the natives, and then they stayed as long as the war went on, and then took all their stuff and left, which left the native people saw some, you know, canned goods and clothes and all kinds of things that they wanted. And so they tried to basically recreate the white man's magic to make these resources come in. They were literally wanted to see their ship come in, and so they would go and use vines to make radio antennas, and they would pick up the old books, and they didn't know which was right side up or upside down, but they would sit and read those in the office, or build airstrips and make airplanes out of straw and control towers, trying to get the ships or the planes to come in and to bring them goods. And looking that from an outside perspective, it's, you know, seems like really bizarre behavior that they're really not aware of their place or their relationship to the universe, not really aware of a cause and effect in the same way that we are. But yet, if somebody were to come in from the outside and look at our own culture, they might also say that, you know, that we're not really self-aware of ourselves. And so Yeah, when we look at self-awareness, we can say that there's degrees of self-awareness, that when you look in the mirror and recognize yourself, you know, that's one level, but it's different from, say, being aware of your behaviors or how the universe functions around you.
Okay. Well, without going into great depth, review with us the different stages of cultural historical evolution during the course of human history, and maybe its corresponding mode of thought or worldview that defines it. And if you could please focus on the magical.
Okay.
And then the mythical, and then the sequential. All right? Like the sequential, the birth of an industry and science, the pursuit of material wealth, the mythical, the birth of agriculture and the emergence of God and warfare, and the magical, the corresponding to the hunter-gatherer tribal culture. I think we could learn a lot and then touch on the holistic based upon the shared commonality between people in a pursuit for sustainable prosperity, which is something that is emerging, I believe, more today because of our crisis than it has before because of the crisis. Your thoughts, please.
Sure. There's a fascinating correlation between the technologies that are used by a culture to survive and everything that blossoms from that. That, you know, if you are a hunter-gatherer society and you're digging up roots with sticks and hunting game, that it tends to lead to, first of all, a small population size, and that it kind of dictates from there the structure of your government, that they tend to be very egalitarian, that nobody has more power than another, that even the chief, regardless of whether male or female, the chief is going to be out there getting food just like everybody else. And it tends to be connected with this kind of what we call magical thinking that I was describing with the whole with the people in the South Pacific. And so that's one worldview that is very alien to us because it's very different from our own worldview. And an interesting thing happens when you get into agriculture and start plowing fields with livestock and machinery, and you have the bumping along and the plow, which makes it impractical for women to do the plowing because it can cause miscarriages and pregnancy. And so it tends to be the food supply is dominated by men doing most of the work, and the result, and you've probably heard this through Ken Wilber's work or Daniel Quinn or Derek Jensen have all talked about this and how the rise of agriculture brought us hierarchical systems and the exploitation of people and women and children and the environment. And then when we get more into what I call a sequential worldview that's really based on industrial infrastructure, then we have very linear thinking that starts with interchangeable parts and assembly lines. And each of these levels is able to support a bigger population in the first place, and it results in changes in every aspect of society, from the way we raise our children to our politics, how we approach politics and education. So it really changes all of these aspects, and right now we're really transitioning from sort of an industrial infrastructure to more of an informational one, which is again changing all aspects of society.
That's a very good way of summarizing that. Thank you. Today, I believe we witness an excess of mythological thinking. For example, the prevalence of fundamentalistic Christianity, intent on believing the Bible as a non-historical document and strictly divinely revealed, and then reductionist science, which has turned into a kind of scientific religion itself that feels technology can solve all human problems. So would you look at this from your perspective and expand on this concept of what are our views as a dominant world paradigm that's shaping American politics and society today, since most people are sitting at home getting virtually all their reality from the manufactured perceptions over television or the internet or newspapers?
Sure. It's really fascinating to sort of see these transitions in action because, I mean, if you go back as recently as Henry David Thoreau's time in the 1850s, it was still popularly believed in American culture that seeds could spring up magically from the ground, that we still had that magical aspect to our culture, or that, you didn't need a seed for a plant or a tree. That while most things grew from seeds, that if a tree popped up miles from any of others of its kind, that it was magic it had popped up like that. So we're talking about Americans in the very recent past that had a very magical worldview. And then that, of course, was already in transition to a mythical worldview that, or was actually dominated by a mythical worldview at that time, in seeing that that this is the world of God and the devil and philosophical principles, and at the same time beginning to transition into some of the things that led to the Industrial Revolution, and so. The sweeping changes that come through, it's kind of fascinating. If you take a look at one aspect, say the rise of the railroads, when the first railroads came along, nobody had ever really traveled faster than animal speed before. And so they called it the annihilation of space and time to be able to, because it made the land smaller to be able to travel so quickly. And it really changed people's experience and sort of rewired their brains that in the past people would have gone into, say, a small grocery store where all the everything was packed in tight around them, very personal experience, which is very much like the experience of bumping along in a stagecoach and sort of interacting with people in the fields along the way. Well, when you get in a train and you're going faster, you're no longer having that intimate first-person experience. You're looking at the big panorama, looking out there at the distance because the foreground moves by too quickly. And so it started to rewire our brains that now we actually tend to prefer that, that instead of it being about the journey, it's more about the destination. Let's get there quickly. And even our grocery stores have turned into what's effectively railroad tracks with a panoramic view of all these products. So,
I like that analogy. Thank you for that. One last quick question because we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. Today there's a back-to-the-land tribal consciousness emerging, somewhat associated with New Age thought in some circles that seems to harken back to magical thinking of the hunter-gatherer. And a truly holistic model would incorporate the best of each level of cultural development and want to discard that which is an impediment to growing awareness. Is it true indigenous societies today have certain qualities that would help modern societies immensely, such as respect for nature, but it is rather regressive to think we can all return to that? Your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't actually see it. I see it as a distinction that I go to a lot of primitive skills rendezvous. I do wilderness survival skills and find people that are very conscious of their connection with the earth and trying to live more sustainably. And it's really a different level. It's not quite the same as going back. It's sort of a new tribal consciousness, if you will, kind of a mystical approach to the land. And it's very much arising from the technology that's just showing our connection to the earth in a different way that, when you get down to the genetics of it, we're not that much different from other creatures in this world. And so there is sort of this new tribal consciousness, as you say, that's coming back, and that we can use that to live more sustainably, and really work past some of these things that are imperiling life on Earth at the present.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and sharing. I look forward to another conversation. This is a fascinating topic, and you've given us a lot of short but good incisive understandings of it. All the best to you.
Well, I appreciate the chance to come on the show, Gary. Thank you.
Thomas Appel, ELPEL, author of Roadmap to Reality. We have a lot of exciting programs coming up all this week, a lot of commentaries, and we're looking at what we can do to awaken to how we have ended up with such disparities between the rich and poor, where our environment is under assault, and yet there is no responsible measure to either slow it down or stop it or to clean it up. We have so many people who are in bankruptcy, whose homes are underwater, 50 million Americans, their mortgages are underwater. We can't sustain this, and it's not so hard to see the solutions. I will be offering some solutions to how to help the poor, the middle class, help rebalance some of the excessive taking of power by one small group and to itself. America has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the wealthiest 1%, and that's not what it was about at the beginning, and it shouldn't be that today. There's a reasonable and responsible way we can address all these issues. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. And at 6 o'clock today, go to the Progressive Radio Network, because I'll be interviewed for an hour by Mitchell Rabin on his show. Have a nice day.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.